I like it where something might fail, because that's what makes my bits tingle. And then, you know, be able to come out at the end of it a better version of myself and go, I could do that. And so the downside is that I'm always looking to the next goal. I don't have much of a rear view mirror, which is good because of my childhood. People say, you've done well considering your childhood. And I'm like, you know, it's 36 years, you know, it's 36 years since I left home. And they go, yeah, but even so, I know, no, you didn't hear me, mate. It's 36 years since I left home. There's a sell-by date for blaming your parents, because, you know, for the first 18 years I lived at home and life was shit. But then one day I get up and all of a sudden I make the decisions every single day about what I eat, where I live, how I conduct myself, how I speak to people, how I treat people, how much food I eat, you know, whether I exercise. I make those decisions to this day, 100 times a day.
Are we born with the fear of public speaking? Or are we born with the belief that we're just not good enough? No. The only fears that we are born with is the fear of loud noises and the fear of falling over, which tells us that everything is learned, which means everything can be unlearned. This episode is the episode for you if you have some limiting beliefs in your life. I had the absolute pleasure to interview David Thomas, world memory champion, professional speaker, bodybuilder, and just an awesome top round lad. We use David Thomas as a wonderful role model to talk about memory strategies in the Confident Club, but also about beliefs. David's story shows us that it's not about your background, your education, or your upbringing. It's about choices, and that we get to choose what we believe. This is one of my favorite episodes I think I've ever recorded. Unfortunately, this was from the last season, so I didn't get it released. So this is a year old, but we're finally getting out right now. And this is the episode for you. I absolutely love this episode. I hope you enjoy it too. And don't forget to leave a little review and tell us what you enjoyed about this episode and hit that subscribe button so you know when next week's episode is available. Without further ado, enjoy this episode with David Thomas. Welcome to the show, David Thomas. How are you?
I'm all right, mate. Everything's cooking on gas, as we say up north.
That's what we like. That's what we like. Now, David, I know we've had like a pre-chat just before we've press recorded, but I'm going to read this out. I've got some amazing achievements that I've done my research on, and this is incredible before we get into the actual talk. But if I've got this correct, David, World Memory Championship medalist, International Grandmaster of Memory, Guinness Memory Record breaker for reciting pi to 22,500 digits. I think that was back in 19. World Memory holder for memorizing and reciting 100 packs of individually shuffled packs of playing cards. US Memory Record breaker for memorizing 160 digits in 5 minutes. And US Memory Champion in 2007. And obviously, quite recently as well, you've also become a competitive bodybuilder as well. That is an incredible set of achievements there, David. I'm absolutely amazed into that. That's incredible.
Well, now you mention it, yeah, I am. I can't deny.
I love it. Well, I'm quite interested. Yeah,
it is quite interesting because I think when you do things, when you experience things, or when you have these amazing achievements, yeah, I mean, and everybody does, right? Everybody has some amazing achievements. When you do them, you don't always see them as amazing because you can do them. We always look at other people who do things like, you're a professional magician. You could do magic, and I'd be like, that's bloody brilliant. Like, and you'd be like, no, dude, it's not that difficult. And then I go, all right, okay, maybe it isn't hard. But at the same time, we tend to have that mysticism that goes around things that we don't know or understand. And yet in reality, when we do it, we always pass it off a bit quick as not being great. And yet, you know, I have done some good stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. You've got an inspiring story I'd love to hear. So obviously in the intro that's been put on top of this about what you actually do, I'd love to dive into your inspirational story, because obviously we have a mutual friend in Steve McDermott. And as I said to you on the pre-chat, feel like I know you, because obviously Steve shares your story. It's a wonderful story. So would you mind sharing, David, a little bit about obviously what it is you do, but also your inspirational story?
Well, my background was a bit difficult growing up. I had a very tricky upbringing at the hands of an alcoholic mother and a physically abusive stepfather. My stepfather was 65 when I was six, and my mother used to do crazy stuff in the house and things that I wouldn't, you know, it's all out there, but it was kind of think the worst of the worst. And that's what my mother used to do to me when she was drunk. And that just led to a very difficult kind of 12-year period between the age of 4 and 16, by which time I went off the rails and I started committing petty crime. I've got a police caution, attempted suicide twice. I nearly killed a police officer one night coming out of a shop at 3 o'clock in the morning in Leeds. I got expelled from school and I got a criminal conviction. So at 16, my life was kind of down the toilet. And the only job I could get was working in a factory, pound an hour, packing Christmas gifts into boxes. But I wasn't going to go on the rock and roll, on the dole, as they said it back in the day. And I got myself a job and I did that, then became a firefighter. And really, becoming a firefighter was probably the most significant thing that happened, because at the age of 20, I was in a mess. I was drinking very heavily. I wasn't alcoholic, but I was spending more on alcohol than I was on food, living on my own in a tiny bedsit. And then all of a sudden, I applied to become a firefighter, and only one in 40 got in back in the day. And straight away, I'm in the top 2.5%. And all my mates were brickies, sparkies, plasterers, working class manual guys. And I'm a firefighter, and it's like, Dave's a fireman. This is great. And I had respect from other people, but I also got a certain level of self-respect. And that was utterly transformational. And that made me get my act together.
Brilliant. Yeah. And then from that obviously point, you saw something on TV that changed your life.
I did. I was watching TV and there was a terrible show on with Philip Schofield talking telephone numbers. And the bottom line is if they would see a memory again, I can't remember the word. generates the word, right? So they would generate digits. And if they appear, if live TV show, if they could, and if those numbers appeared in your telephone number, then you could phone up and win 20 grand. And I'm like, well, fine, I need the money, right? So I'm sat there and a guy came on. And one of the things he did was memorize a pack of playing cards and then got tested. And this was live. And so he got 3 minutes to memorize the cards and then they placed them up on a board. And then he got tested 10 times. And so they say, what's card number three? And he goes, it's a jack of clubs. And he goes, where's the four of hearts? And he goes, it's card number 42. And you've done magic. And to me, this was magical. I'm like, how is he doing that? Because that's 104 pieces of information, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, with a card and a suit. And also the order. And also, you know, both the, you know, where they are and so on. And it all just was too much. But then I was in Waterstones in Leeds a few months later, walked in, and I said to the guy behind the counter, I said, have you got any books on memory? And they went, yeah, because I thought it might be good for exams, because I was failing my exams in the fire service. I went and bought his book and found out I could do it.
Is this Dominic O'Brien's book?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, great. Yeah.
So what was really weird is Dominic was the guy I saw on TV. It was his book that I bought. And then 8 months later, I went to the World Memory Championships and competed against him. And that was a real hair is, you know, just where the hairs come up on the back of your neck moment. Because it's very difficult. It sounds all really kind of Hollywood cliche. But trust me, I was sat in a bedsit in Halifax, mold on the walls. I couldn't get anywhere else. You know, I was a firefighter. I loved my job, but I didn't even have a car. I had no money. And then I'm just watching TV. And then all of a sudden, you know, 8 months later, I turn up to Simpsons in the Strand, one of the greatest tea rooms in London. I go to this room where they used to hold World Chess Championship matches 100 years before. And I go the day before the competition just to check it out. I go up to the, you know, to the glass door, look through the window, and there's Dominic. The guy I'd seen on the TV, and he's kind of got his head in his hands and he sat there concentrating. There's nobody else in the whole room. And I walked through the door and I'm like stuttering, you know, and I'm like, you don't know me. My name's David. I saw you on TV. And he was just the most amazing guy. And we became great friends. And even went in 2014 to Iran to spend 2 days speaking at a conference together. How life goes, huh?
Our life changes, yeah. Yeah, because we're obviously big fans of the Tony Buzan,
mind mapping, and Dominic O'Brien is the, I think he gives the foreword in the mind mapping book. But yeah, so obviously you 8 months later, you've gone from that position. What led you to even to get into this? I know a lot of people ask you why, especially within your pie, the 22,500 digits thing. But why did you decide to just go into that from obviously where you were?
I bought the book because I wanted to learn how to pass my exams. And then once I realized how easy it was to do the memory stuff, once you had a great process and technique, and that really it had nothing to do with intellect, intelligence, education, background, socioeconomic factors, none of that. It literally was just a process. And I was like, I could do it. And then it was like, well, maybe I could do it a bit better. What else is in this book? And then he said, you can memorize a pack of playing cards. And I'm like, okay, I saw him do that on TV, but that's probably going to be a bit beyond me. But let me have a go and see if I can do it. And then once I did it with a bit of practice, I could. And of course, I mean, I go to the gym. I am a competitive bodybuilder now. I can only lift what I can lift. And I can't go again in 2 hours and lift it all again. 2 hours and lift it all again. Lift 2 hours and then lift. I can't keep doing that. You know, there's a limit. And so we are preconditioned to incremental progress. You know, you go and start a job and, you know, you get 5% pay rise or a 10% pay rise or no pay rise. But basically, you move forward a step at a time. But when it comes to improving the brain and improving the doing memory techniques, you can have exponential improvement. So, you know, I can go from being able to remember a list of 10 objects to like 50 to 100 in a matter of a few days. I could go from getting a pack of cards and being able to remember one suit, which is what I did. I thought I'll take out one suit, just clubs, and memorize those 13, see if I can do it, to being able to do 2, 3, and then a full pack in days. And then you go from one pack. So I went from being able to not memorize anything to 8 months later going to the World Memory Championships and being able to memorize 14 packs of cards in an hour. And you just go, it's incredible. And so so the question is why? And I suppose what I understand now looking back, and this isn't just hindsight, I've always wanted to be the best version of myself. And I enjoy personal growth. So whilst it was fun being able to tell other people I could do this stuff, it's how I felt about myself that was key. So a mate of mine pointed out the difference. Some people are internally referenced and some people are externally referenced. Most speakers are externally referenced. What they do is they stand up on stage because they want people to laugh at their jokes and clap them off and then come up and say they were amazing. And I'm not interested in any of that. I'm just interested in how I grow personally. I want to be able to do things today that I couldn't do yesterday. I want to learn something new every single day that makes me a better version of myself. And that doesn't make me better than anybody else. It just makes me wired for growth. And every time I've had some success, the day after, it's like it never happened. So that's the downside of ambition. Ambition is a double-edged sword. It drives you on and you achieve great things. And for a guy with my background who had no money, no investors, no shareholders, no family help, no team to work with, no peer group, no mastermind group, no networking, before the internet, no Facebook group, to go out there and then start speaking on major stages, competing in memory competitions, doing all the other stuff I've done, is genuinely extraordinary, but it's driven by the fact that I just like to do things that are hard and with a bit of jeopardy. I like it where something might fail because that's what makes my bits tingle. And then, you know, be able to come out at the end of it a better version of myself and go, I could do that. And so the downside is that I'm always looking to the next goal. I don't have much of a rear view mirror, which is good because of my childhood. People say, you've done well considering your childhood. And I'm like, you know, it's 36 years, you know, it's 36 years since I left home. And they go, yeah, but even so, I know, no, you didn't hear me, mate. It's 36 years since I left home. There's a sell-by date for blaming your parents. Because, you know, for the first 18 years I lived at home and life was shit. But then one day I get up and all of a sudden I make the decisions every single day about what I eat, where I live, how I conduct myself, how I speak to people, how I treat people, how much food I eat, you know, whether I exercise. I make those decisions to this day, 100 times a day. And that's not, and you go, oh, but it's all, you're influenced by your parents. Well, blah, 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 blah. Yeah, if you let it.
Yeah.
So for me, one of the tenets of my speaking always has been about accepting responsibility. And generally speaking, I work very, very well with entrepreneurs. If somebody said who's the group of people I work best with, it's entrepreneurs, because they all started on their kitchen table with a business and a vision, and they drove it forward and they found a way. And so they're always looking for the edge and how to be better and different. So that's my instinct.
Yeah. Well, I know we're big fans of Paul, and Paul McGee, he's been on the show as well. And he shares his fantastic idea with Jack Canfield about the E plus R equals O. You know, the event plus your response equals your outcome. It's about taking responsibility. Do you think that your drive is shaped because of your past experiences, or where that probably is the question, where is this drive coming from? I'm very similar to you. I always have to put 120% into everything. It's got to be the best version of myself. Where is your drive? Where does that come from?
No idea, and neither do you. You have no idea where it comes from. You'll get a psychologist, they'll sit down and tell you blah, blah, blah. And yet you can take twins that have been in the same house. You know, so I don't know if you've heard of Grant Cardone.
Yeah.
So he's 10X. A billionaire. Yeah, 10X. So he's a loudmouth, big guy. He's done well. You know, he's got a twin, same house, same upbringing, no ambition at all. So the fact is that all this crap that people throw out there and go, oh, it's because of your childhood and your... No, I was in a house with my brother. And my brother has been a very steady corporate guy for 30 years in his adult life. And he's a great guy and utterly and completely different to me. I was born with it. It's, you know, my mother was not like it. My father's not like it. My stepfather wasn't like it. I didn't know anybody who earned, you know, at 20 years old, I didn't know anybody who earned 30 grand a year or ran a business. I didn't know anybody. But I had that. So that instinct, whatever it was just, I was born with it.
Yeah.
And I'm grateful for it in as much as I like being me. I think that's a really, really huge thing when you get into your 50s. You know, there's a reason why suicide for men is highest in their 40s. You'd think it'd be kids in the teenagers or 20s, but it isn't. It's 40s. And I think it's mainly because, you know, when you're in your 20s, you kick off, don't you? And you have all these ambitions and dreams and you go out there and you try loads of stuff and it doesn't matter if you fail. Then you hit 30. What happens, mate? You settle down and get a little bend, don't you? Then all of a sudden it's about mortgage and paying the bills and being there for your family and wanting to be a great parent and all the rest of it. So dreams are still there and ambitions. But underneath, you know, the most important thing is, you know, the thing your ambitions change. The problem is you get to whatever, you know, your girl's one, right? Your girl's one and you are 33.
That's right.
So, you know, 15, 16 years from now, you'll be 48, 49, should be 16, 17, off to university, getting a first job, doing whatever, right? And then all of a sudden, that's why in the 40s, guys sit there and go, look back and they go, "So what happened to all my dreams?"
Yeah.
And I think that's when they start to realize that 40s is a tricky age because you realize those massive, big dreams, because everybody tells you can achieve anything, which is obviously a little load of bollocks. And so that all of a sudden you sit there and you go, okay, that's not true. And then you look forward and go, I've got 20 more years of this.
Yeah.
And you go, and I think that's why guys get into a difficult place mental health-wise. For me, a guy in my 50s, I'm more settled. I'm not saying I had mental health issues in my 40s because my career was going like a train off a cliff. It was amazing. It still is. So I was very happy and I was driven and everything was fine. But in my 50s, I found things have settled down a great deal more and I'm kind of more settled in my own self. In the past, I've always been what I would call happy, but eternally unsettled. just, you know, underneath, it's like, okay, Dave, what are you going to do today? Well, you know, let's do something different. And so, yeah, it's been interesting. It's been interesting. But I have the drive. I still have it because, and I'm fortunate for that because 53 is the age at which it drops off a cliff.
Oh, right. Okay. Right. I've got 20 years to go. Yeah.
Possibly. So the big study done in Finland and what they discovered is whether it's male or female, 53 is the age at which ambition, desire for success, personal cognitive ability, drive, energy levels all drop off a cliff. And it's hormonal. 53 is the average age for menopause. And for men, that's when testosterone has dropped off about, give or take, about 20%. So men lose 1.2% of testosterone from the age of 40. And by the time you get to 53, you've lost nearly 20%. And testosterone is People see it as a sex and muscle building hormone, but in men, it's probably one of the most significant hormones you have, and it's responsible for cognitive abilities, focus, attention, drive, ambition. And that's why, you know, typically if you speak to somebody who's 60, they'll only talk about one thing, retirement. And then you go, what are you going to do? And they're going to go, I'm going to do all the stuff I couldn't do when I was working. And I always go, like what? And they go, you know, and I'm like, no, seriously, I don't, tell me. And they go, well, you know, if spend a bit more time with the grandkids. So you're going to be a cheap babysitter for the grandkids. And they go, I'm just a polemicist. And I don't know it to be weird. It's like they say that. So one of the problems that people have is that when they get older, the mitochondria in the brain cell starts to unravel. So that's what's called X differentiation. It's a brilliant podcast out there that I'm going to take some time out and learn properly because it's about anti-aging. And so this is what happens. And so what happens is the brain needs a certain level of stress. The cell needs a certain level of stress. It's a bit like me going to the gym. I can bench press 300 pounds. If I go and bench press 500 pounds, I'm going to tear my muscles. If I bench press 100 pounds, then my muscles will get smaller. So what I need is to see if I can do 301 or 302 or 304, or at the very, very least do 300 and make sure that I'm continuing to, you know, to maintain. The problem is people go from massive stress in work, 500 pound deadlift, a bench press, to retirement, which is 100 pound bench press. And that's why when you say that people get old overnight, they literally do. Because once you don't have the jeopardy of losing your job, the need to earn an income, and somebody looking over your shoulder at work, what would you do? And so therefore, for me, it's all about, I know it's kind of gone off topic a little bit, but for me, you know, I'm ambitious and I'm driven. I'm 54 and I'm as driven, if not more ambitious now than I ever was. And I'm grateful for that because my testosterone is dropping, presumably, just like anybody else's. And yet I wake up every morning, 5 o'clock, I'm up and out the door. On Christmas Day, I'll be up at 5 o'clock and down the gym. And so I'm grateful to still have that within me. Why I have it, which was the original question like 2 hours ago, I don't know. But I'm glad I do because it gives me a very high quality of life. You know, I once said to my missus, what's it like being with me? She went, every day is an adventure.
Very polite answer, yeah.
Oh, yeah, I can't even work out if that was positive or not. She went, yeah, it's definitely a journey. Because she's not at all. She just wants to be grand. She just wants to be super nana. So she gets in the car and... we call it a nana van. She goes in a little mini club and sets off to Norwich and sees her kids and off to Ramsbottom, off to Huddersfield. So she's great. You know, she loves being super nana. She doesn't want to work. And that's great. I'm not saying you should.
Yeah.
She's just happy doing that. And that would literally send me to an early grave because my brain would just disappear overnight and I'd just be in bits on the floor.
Yeah. I find it fascinating, this whole thing about this drive. You know, the whole point of this podcast was about understanding, unlocking the best version of ourselves and speaking to people like yourself and, you know, just people that have just done remarkable things of where this comes from and what, you know, why this happens. I had someone come on the podcast recently who talked about there isn't really a need to unlock the best version of ourselves because whatever we've got, it's just there already. And it was such a really difficult conversation because it was about this thing called non-duality, about how there's nothing there. It already is what it is. And it's really hard to explain because we're always seeking to unlock something better. And I'm the same. I'm, you know, constantly on personal growth, trying to get better and better, whatever it is I do, you know, put full 100% into it. But what is a best version of yourself?
I like that challenge. That's something to muse on for the rest of the day, isn't it? I think for me, I enjoy immensely being able to do something that I never thought I'd be able to do. Considering I've done some stuff in my life, the single most difficult thing I've ever done was get on a bodybuilding stage, for example. And I did it at 51 years old. I wasn't a kid who just decided he was just going to have a go. I didn't have any drugs. So it was a natural competition. I've never taken any performance enhancing drugs, no steroids, no fat burners, no nothing. It's just been food, diet, water, supplements, and a boatload of training, and you don't know how you're going to look literally until the morning of the show for various reasons. So I spent 8 months of my life eating chicken, vegetables, you know, broccoli, egg whites, not even knowing if I was going to be able to stand on stage, but absolutely committing to it. It was terrifying because I knew I've been watching these competitions for years. I've been sponsoring bodybuilding competitions. I've been going to them, seeing these guys. I knew all the people I would be competing against. A lot of them have been doing it for 20, 30 years. They knew exactly how to do it, get the best out of their physique. And I was going to be standing up on stage next to them, wearing nothing but budgie smugglers and 2 gallons of fake tan. It was literally terrifying. And to do it was just the most exhilarating thing because it was something I didn't think I'd ever do. And I did. And I got there and I looked like a bodybuilder on stage.
Yeah. The photo's amazing. I've seen it online. It's great.
And so for me, being the best version of yourself is a very kind of cliched, stereotypical phrase, to be fair. But for me, there are two things that appeal to me. First of all, I like to find out if there's things I can't do that then all of a sudden through sheer grind, determination, great work, and just, you know, pushing into it, I find I can do. That's nice. The second thing is I like being exceptional. We talked about this beforehand. I'm a working class lad from Halifax, and I still live here because I love the town, I love the people. Everyone's just, nobody cares what car you drive or how much money you've got. We're just all in it together, right? But at the end of the day, I understand I'm better than most people. Not better as in a better human being or more caring or whatever, but I'm better at being able to motivate myself to do stuff. And I understand that. And unfortunately, you know, as much as some of us like, none of us operate in a vacuum. So, for example, we talked about YouTube earlier. If I get 100,000 subscribers, what does that mean? The only way you can measure success is by looking at what other people have achieved. So, for example, I know that on YouTube, if you get 100,000 subscribers, it puts you in the top 1%. If you get 1 million subscribers, it puts you in the top 0.1%. And so that, you know, if I do a YouTube channel and I get 100,000 subscribers, by definition, I'm better than 99 other people out of 100. I'm in the top 1%. I'm not a better person. I'm not a better YouTuber than them per se. You know, other people, their content would be worth, have more value to some people. But we all operate on some basis on that level. Some, you know, being the best version of myself is being, I'm highly competitive. I like beating other people. I like being better than others when it comes into a competitive environment.
Yeah, that's a great answer. Yeah, that's amazing. I love
it. Which people don't. People want to still give out cups for 8th place at primary school and everybody's a winner. I'm not in that camp. Yeah. I'm not.
I've got all that to come with. That's going to be interesting.
It's not, you know, it's got, you know, I think it's just more primal than that. It's survival of the fittest. The reason we have the quality of life we have now is because people did crazy stuff in the past, you know, for 30,000 years, whichever book you read. The evolution has just been people driving stuff on and being a bit crazy and trying, and, you know. And it's like, you know, look, people look at Elon Musk and go, it's ridiculous that he's worth $300 billion. And I go, but we're going to be living on Mars in 20 years because of him. Yeah, and they go, yeah, but he doesn't need all that money, does he? And I go, didn't you not hear the bit about living on Mars? You know, it's not fair. Life's not fair.
Yeah.
We would love it all, to be fair. We would love it if everybody, you know, lived this kind of happy clappy, you know, we all earn the same money. We all have a great life. The health service is amazing, but that's never going to happen. I mean, there are some ideals that are worth working towards, but ultimately, you know, they reckon, and I know this is a bit silly, but I'll say it anyway, but they reckon that if all the money in the world got split up evenly amongst everybody, the people who've got the most now would have it all back inside 10 years. And, you know, there was a good friend of mine, very good friend of mine, who was earning about 24 grand a year, won 75,000 quid, all gone in 2 years. Then they were earning 24,000 quid a year. Think about that. So they're earning 2 grand a month, bit of tax taken off, maybe 1,500 quid a month, and yet went through 75,000 quid, won it on a game show, and it was all gone in 2 years. You know, so the thing is, it's just the classic thing, isn't it? You just think, well, if you give people money, they would be responsible. But that's a very long and deep conversation, and don't necessarily have the most knowledge about those things. But I think the competitive nature of life is a good thing. It just drives us on to be better version. You know, businesses become better because of capitalism, because of a competitive nature of the marketplace, for example. And I think it's the same for us as human beings. We all want to do well. We all want to get recognition, and it is nice to win.
Yeah, I agree. I see something very similar between me and you. I'm quite an impatient man, always trying to, I'm always told, not always told to slow down, but just want to do the best that I can. You know, I just want to do things quick. And it's not as if like I think that I'm going to die or something in 5 years, that I want to just try and get everything ever achieved. But I just have such a big drive. I find it quite difficult sometimes to talk to people who are quite unambitious. And I've you know, made myself in lots of camps where people are quite happy. And there's no, I'm not judging anyone on this and any listeners, but there's a few people that I know who are very happy to be in a shitty job and moan about how shit life is and not taking the responsibility to do something about it. And I've often, you know, found myself excluded from those camps because I'll take the responsibility to go have the life that I want. And if I want to be the best version of myself, I will. Are you similar to me that you might find, are you impatient around those kind of people? Because I find it really hard to understand.
Let me ask a different question. Why do you talk to those people?
This is true.
No, like I'm asking you now. It's not rhetorical. Why do you talk to them?
I guess I think about you are the person, aren't you, with the five people that you hang around with. There is no answer, really, is there? Shouldn't really be, because it's not really helping, is it?
No, I'm putting you on the spot a bit, but the way I operate on a two-question principle. When somebody says to me in the gym, because when you go in the gym, it's a very kind of, you never quite know what anybody's got. You know, there are guys in there that are driving, you know, I go past the odd Ferrari in the garage, and I know somebody in the gym's driving that Ferrari, and it's a 200, well, actually, somebody's just got an SF90 Stradale, it must be 400 grand. So somebody in the gym's driving a 400 that, but you wouldn't know. So when you're talking to people, everyone's just the same. We're all in there, you know, all meatheads trying to pump iron, right? And so you never quite know what people have got or where they are or how, you know, what kind of job they do. So I always have a two-question principle. If somebody says to me, how are you doing? I always go, I'm all right. And then if they ask a second question, I know they're really interested. So when they turn around, and I do this even with my kids, I go, yeah, everything's fine. And if they turn and go, no, tell me about your week. And I go, okay, well, then this is, yeah, I've had a bad week, good week, got this, that, whatever, right? But I have a two-question principle because people don't really care. The one thing I've come to understand about, and this is kind of slightly off topic, but the only person who truly cares about you is you. And this is not some motivational cliched bullshit, seriously. So, like, you know, I live with Karen. She's my soulmate. She's my partner. I work from home. She lives with me. She works with me on occasions, but is basically does super nana stuff. So we are around each other a huge amount of the time. If I go on big trips, she comes with me. We're glued at the hip, right? We're like Siamese twins. But if I say, oh, you know, I'm feeling, you know, I've done my shoulder in at the gym again, sweetheart. She goes, oh, that's really terrible. And then she'll just go, what do you want for tea? And I'm like,
nice, yeah, yeah.
Telling you about my shoulder. She goes, no, no, I hate your shoulder, you know, but just take it easy. Take an naproxen, do what you need to do. Go and see the physio. You'll be fine. But what do you want for tea? Right. And then she goes, well, what do I want for tea? And it's like, I was talking about my shoulder. Right. And so she cares. She cares very, very, very deeply about me. Right. On a whole different level than I've ever had before in a relationship. But I tell you now, we get up in the morning, first thing we think of is us. And then we think of the next person. But 85% of whatever the working day is, us thinking of us. People just don't care that much. So I don't try and convince people of anything. I don't anymore. I have in the past. I said, would it be great if? And if people don't have that in them, because you said, where does your drive come from? It was in me from the day I was born. In fact, about 15 years ago, I was doing a talk and I said, I didn't have any ambition as a kid. And one guy just went, yes, you did. And I went, No, I didn't. Honestly, I was just drifting along. He went, you did. And I love a challenge like that. I never got upset. And I was like, interesting. He said, no, if you went back and had a look, it'd be definitely, there'd be something there. And I went, can I ever give you a call? Because I'd like to chat about this. And he did. And then I realized that that's always been there. So two little examples. When I was 13 and things were going really badly at home, I just decided I wanted to get out of the house. I started running. And I get myself a little runny, like a little kind of square thing to come, you know, a little circuit to come back to the house. And that was the first day. Second day, I timed myself. Third day, I wanted to be at the second day's time. And then within a year, I was the fastest cross-country runner in the year. And within 2 years, I was the fastest cross-country runner in the school. And by the time we left in the fifth year, which is year 11, we did the cross-country against the sixth form, and I beat them as well. That was there. That was just in me. My instinct was just to, today I'm going to be faster than I was yesterday. I can remember I bought a paper round when I was 16. So near me, there's a little village. They didn't have a paper shop open on a Sunday. You went to this grotty little hole, like a little tiny shop that was only open on a Sunday. And you bought the round. It cost me 80 quid. And I bought the round. And the woman there would sell us the papers. So it was like the Times back in Sunday Times for 50p, you paid 28p, and then you had your round. So I delivered it, 80 people, give or take. And I bought it in September, and I bought it off two lads I knew who were twins. And I said, what did you get in tips for Christmas? And it said 16 quid. I went, okay, so I'm getting 13 quid for a round, 16 quid tips for Christmas. That seems fair enough. So I get to Christmas and I just think, I'm going to see if I can do better than that. So I went and bought a box of Christmas cards for 5 quid. And I wrote everybody, dear John, your paper boy, happy Christmas, David. And there was only one person that 80 odd people did not give me a tip. And I got £80.
Brilliant. Yeah.
So my instinct was always like, I'm going to do better than they did. Not because I wanted to beat them, but just because I believe in my ability to be exceptional. The thing is, that is very, very, very rare. And so, yeah. And you know, I've got three kids. Cam's got two kids. We've got five kids between them. I can see, you know, I can see. Certainly one of them is doing very well, but in a job they probably don't love, you know, and you could have that conversation as well. So the thing is, I just realized that, you know, when I sit and talk to people and I tell them I do a job I'm good at, that I really enjoy, that pays me a fortune, where I travel the world, you know, all my clients pay on time, blah, blah, blah. I understand I'm in that 1%. And we know that 80% of people just don't love the jobs. So I don't know, mate, really. I think when you turn around and say, you know, you talk about people, the fact is I understand that I just, over the years, my friendship list has got shorter and shorter, to the point where I have people who, you know, I call passing friends in the gym, and we always chat and say hello. And actually, I'm very popular in the gym because I'm just taught to people. I listen, you see, when people come up and I go, how are you doing? Oh, yeah, and my hips knackered and this and that, and I'll listen, you see, because I'm kind and nice. Yeah. But I have no interest in sharing what I do because, you know,
yeah,
people don't care, and so therefore when you talk to other people, Ricky, coming back to your original point, the fact is you're never going to change them. It's never going to happen.
The way
we are, see, you know, I was like that at 13 with the running. I was like that at 16 when I bought a paper round. It was in me from birth. It's just who I am. If it's not in them, then it's not going to come out later on. There's almost nobody you meet at 40 who all of a sudden decides they're going to run a business and becomes mega successful.
Yeah. It's so true. And it's about what you said earlier on. It's not about caring about anybody else's. It's about how it makes you feel. So being exceptional, being the best, if it makes you feel good, then why not go after it, seek after it and do all the wonderful things to make you feel great, to be exceptional. Why not? I think probably my thought process in the minute is probably because it's linked to a family member. So there's more of an emotional connection rather than just friends who probably I still care about as friends, but not as point as one of my family members who are probably going through it. So that's probably why that's linked to it. But it is a case, isn't it, of actually about what I feel, no one else, you know. Well, David,
problem is if you look for external validation of any kind, almost certainly you will be disappointed. I know this sounds like a cliche, but it's been very, very true for me. If you do badly, everybody will come in and support you. You see this on Facebook or social media. You put up and you go, I'm having a terrible day. This has happened, that's done. You get 50 comments. Oh, don't worry, hun, you'll be fine. God, you know, tomorrow's another day. You turn around and see you've just got a new contract for work and it's 100,000 quid. Nobody comments.
Yeah. It's the same in the street, isn't it? How are you? I'm fucking brilliant. Oh, all right, calm down, knobhead. What's going on?
So I had somebody in the gym about a year ago. I said, yeah, I'm brilliant. I went, you can't be. Everybody's... And I go, I'll tell you what, let me just tell you how I'm doing. You know, I'm in fantastic physical shape. I have no health issues at all. I come down and train. I'm a competitive bodybuilder. I've got a successful business. I live with my soulmate. We've got 5 kids. They're all fine. 4 grandkids. They're in amazing shape. I said, we're going to buy our home next year. We've got no mortgage. We've got no debt. And they go, okay, maybe you're doing brilliant. But most people, and I'm like, honestly, if I was doing brilliant, you know, if I was doing shit, I'd tell you. But the fact is, I'm doing brilliant, so I'm going to say I'm doing brilliant. And I don't know. It just comes down to the same old thing. My experience is that when you're doing, and I've experienced this myself in reverse, when somebody says to me they're doing really well, my instinct is almost never to turn around and go, oh, well done. It almost never is. Straight away, say, like, if one of my speaking mates gets a £10,000 fee, which I've never had, I've had a $10,000 fee in the States for an hour, but I've never had a 10 grand fee. If somebody turned around to me and go, I've got 10,000 quid. I'm like, straight away, I'm thinking, I've never had that. What can I do to get that?
Yeah, how do I get that?
And I don't, and I love the fact they got it because now they sent a benchmark.
Yeah.
I'm like, right. If he can get it, and I know him, and he's okay, and I'm okay, and we kind of at similar-ish level, I can do that. How did you do it? Where is it? Is it big? I did it. But I don't. My instinct is not to sit there and go, "Real congratulations." I'll say it, but I don't really feel it. Yeah, and it's the same with this. When you meet other people, and you turn up and they go, "How are you doing?" And you go, "Great. I've just got a contract for my podcast has been taken on by Spotify. They're going to pay me 10 million quid. I'm going to be the next Joe Rogan," and they go, just see how many people go. So a friend of mine bought a big house and he said, we had loads of people around over Christmas, friends, family, new house. And he said, not one person mentioned the house. So a couple of weeks ago, we stayed with my son-in-law, daughter-in-law and son-in-law, their house. They went away. They've got a very nice house and we were looking after the bairn and the dogs. And they got stuck in London, train strikes, and eventually managed to get back to Leeds. I went to pick them up. And they're having two like cabin things built in the garden, right? These huts that people tend to have, right? One's going to be like a big fancy kitchen. Another one's going to be where they can sit and kind of enjoy the evening. And, I went and picked them up and I said, yeah, all right. Yeah. And we got in the car. And straight away, the lad just went, oh, what do you think of the new huts? And I went, I don't know. Yeah. Just tell me what they are again. We sat there and been staring at them out there because you look at the living room, you can see the huts. But I've no interest. I don't care. So the thing is that people are like, and it just doesn't register. Because the thing is that people understand that if you are successful, probably a load of stress has come with it, and all the other stuff. You've got to deal with a team of people. And so there is the one thing I think may be a bit tricky for you, mate, is that because you're ambitious, driven, want to do better, you're looking to improve your lot, you've got lots of learnings that you do, that either A, somebody else is going to want to learn it from you, or B, that if you've done it and given them the inspiration, they're going to want to do it as well. And I found out that those two things almost never happen. If they wanted to learn it, they'd have gone out and done it. If they had the ambition, they would have already had a go. And so the fact is, mate, you just got to understand, you get two groups of people. Right. Well, three kind of, I think. You get those people who are like the year gang, right? So, if you phone me up and you go, Dave, I've just found this thing about, that whatever, and I've just did it. And I'm like, brilliant, teach me, right? So, we're in, we chit chat, right? Then you've got people at the other end that you've got to manage, basically family. And that isn't just parents or siblings that you we're talking about kids.
Yeah.
You've got a 1-year-old that's all nice and lovely and beautiful and fluffy. And then at 6 years old, she punches somebody in the face at school and you're going, and then all of a sudden 18, she comes home with, an armful of tattoos and you're going, right, we need a bit of chat. She's like, no, Dan, that's not happening. Right. And so all of a sudden, you've got to stuff over here. You know, my son got a tattoo. His first tattoo was on his arm underneath. And he says, I'm not here for a long time. I'm here for a good time. And I'm like, hardly Shakespeare, is it, son? You know what I mean? Like, what are you doing? Anyway, eventually got a sleeve and got it covered up. But really, right? That was his first tattoo. So the thing is, but then in the middle, you've got these people that you come across. And what you can do is you can share a little bit. You work with them on some level. You know, you bump into them, coffee shop, down the gym, and you just chit chat and you kind of, and you go on through. But what you have to do is morph. And, you know, for me, what I've always done is I started out being a big people pleaser. Then I went through an aggressive phase where I was like, fuck you. And then you're either on my train or fuck off. And then I've come back to being a people pleaser. So I don't mean a people pleaser as in get on the floor and be all submissive. What I mean is I want to find out what makes people happy, see if I can help. And so therefore, I talk to people, how are you doing? So there's a guy in the gym who's got cancer, and every day I say, how are you doing? And he goes, I'm all right. Yeah, I'm fine. Anything I can do? No. Okay. Well, and I can see it means something to him that I ask.
Yeah.
But those are the people in the middle. And so, you know, but everybody now, I just, you know, I see what I can do, and I just want to be there for people and see how I can help. So to me, being a people pleaser was a weak thing to do as a kid.
Yeah.
But now as an adult, in my sixth decade, because I'm 54, I see it as a real superhero skill. Superhero skill. Because the worst thing in the world for me would be to get where I don't want to be around other people, where I don't really like other people and don't, you know, And I get all turned into that grizzled old, cliched, angry old man who just starts shouting at, who just says politically incorrect things because he can.
Yeah.
And all that stuff. I had an argument with a guy the other week who was 18. He says, what about this? And I said, well, you've got two choices. I said, the world has changed and that's not acceptable. Well, it was when I was a kid. I went, yeah, I get that. I said, but you've got two choices. You either carry on saying it, carry on barking at the moon and just become more isolated. Or you change and take on offer everything that this amazing world has to offer. It's a binary choice, mate. And from now until the day I drop dead, it'll be the second one. So whatever happens, you know, people go on about, you know, people want to be, you know, non-binary. What does that even mean? I don't know. But if somebody says to me they want to be called they instead of he or she, I'll do it. Because I just think it's a good thing to do at this moment in time. I says in 10 years, they'll feel different. I said, because I don't see 50-year-olds doing it. That's what I always make. It's somebody who's 20, you know. 20, you don't have a say in the world. You've done naught, mate. You've sucked every resource out of the system for 20 years. Like in all your parents' life, you've taken an education and it's been paid for by me. And now you tell me you want to be called there. Absolutely, all day, every day, I'll do it. Yeah, because I know in 10 years you may feel differently. I'm not saying you will not want to be called there. And I understand that that's what you feel now. So I'll sit and listen because I'm interested. But I also understand that things, you know, what I feel now is definitely not what I thought when I was 40. And holy shit, it isn't what I thought when I was 20.
Yeah.
So I respect people and just enter into the conversation and be hopefully be on the right side of it as it goes through. And I find those things more fascinating than offensive. What's offensive about calling somebody there? Why would people get angry about that?
Yeah.
And the older I get, the more I have a wider perspective on things now than I did when I was younger. You know, everything was maybe a bit too limited. It's like, oh, that's ridiculous. And I'm not saying I would have said that about there, but yeah.
Yeah, that's a fascinating answer. Well, obviously, I know you got to get off soon, haven't you? You've got to have your chicken and veg. So before I let you go.
I'm not starving here. I'm not starving here yet.
obviously, we didn't get to chat about a lot of the things, actually. I really enjoyed the conversation. I found a quote that you mentioned in one of your talks, which I think is absolutely brilliant in line with what we've been discussing, which was, our legacy is not what we earn, or what our house looks like. It is the number of people that we impact as we go through our life. And I know that you're currently obviously working in the presentation skills for CEOs. Tell us a little bit about that and obviously where people can find that.
One of the things that was the greatest revelation for me was that I could teach what I was learning. And you know, when I became a memory guy all the way back in 95, 96, I bought the book in 95, competed in 96, 97, third in the world, 98, did my Guinness record. But the greatest thing was teaching other people. So when I went to my first World Memory Championships in 96, I came back, boss pulled me in, he goes, what's all this memory shit? And I went, well, boss, bought this book, went to London, came forth, happy days. He said, can you teach me? I said, yes, I can. So I taught him how to use it for health and safety to pass an exam. And he came back to me and he said, this is amazing. He said, I knew I'd pass before I left the room. And I went, what? He said, yeah, I knew there was some stuff I didn't know, but I also knew what I knew was right because of the stuff you taught me. He said, you need to teach this. And initially I was a bit, because I'm an ambivert, which means I flip between an introvert and an extrovert. So when I'm speaking, I'm an extrovert. When I'm off stage, I'm an introvert. I don't talk to people much. I just get my coffee in a coffee shop, sit down. You know, I'll talk if people talk to me, but I'm not shy. I just don't really talk to people much. But being a speaker allowed me to take this thing that I'd learned and my experiences, but share them with other people. And that was the biggest revelation of all, because everybody learns amazing shit during their lifetime. Everybody does. They all have cool experiences. They just tell them badly. So people go, let me show you the photos, 442 photos of my holiday. And you go, no, I don't want to see them. But tell me the amazing, what was the amazing story? Well, we went into this restaurant in, you know, Utah, and it, you know, and they don't sell alcohol on it. It was a dry county. Do you know what a dry county is? I go, yeah, it's where they don't sell alcohol. How could a pub not sell alcohol? Well, because it's Utah. And so straight away you go, that's interesting.
Yeah.
And so the revelation was to be able to share what it is that I know. And then what I came to understand, particularly the older I get, is that actually, you know, when you get a car, no matter how nice it is, in 6 months it's just a car again. And it's one of those things where they call it mental masturbation, my friend, where what you do is you do what's called future pacing, which you visualize what you want your future to look like, and it releases dopamine into your brain. It makes you feel good. I'm going to get that car, get that house, get this, to get that. But then when you get it, it's like, right, the dopamine doesn't, you don't get the dopamine hit anymore. All of a sudden it just becomes a car and it becomes a house. Of course, the downside is the better car you get, then that becomes a new benchmark. So I was thinking of changing my car, and I've gone from this car to that car to what I've got now. And it's like, well, now I don't want to go back, not even one model. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so the thing for me is that actually, yeah, you know, when we look back on our days, I like money. Don't get me wrong. I like earning money. I like comfort. If people say, what do you want it for? I want it for comfort. I don't want to fly economy anymore. I don't want to drive an economy car. I don't want it to break down. I want a comfortable house. I don't want to live in a small house. I want to live in a detached house. Why? Zero neighbors. I might have somebody over the other side of a fence, but I don't have anybody on the other side of a wall. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
those things matter. Now I'm an old guy, right? I'm an old fucker. I just want comfort. It's not about massive luxury goods. It's just comfort. That's what I want. But at the same time, I do understand that, you know, everything we have is not ours to keep. It's ours to share. And, you know, the impact that we have is not the cars we get or the money we get. It's the number of people you're able to impact. And now I'm up to 500,000 plus. And, you know, and the thing is with things like YouTube channels and social media, you can easily get into the millions in your lifetime. And if you just think about it in those kind of terms, then, you know, go through life, maximize your income for those, because we don't quite know what the future is going to hold. And being a speaker just allows you to do that. So for presentation skills, for me, I work a lot with entrepreneurs and business owners. And the reason is because they get to a certain stage and they realize that they're going to. So a woman's coming on Friday. She's been running this business. They're going to sell for 50 million in 3 years. And she's like, I've got to start going to America, looking at investors, blah, blah, blah. And so she's coming here and she goes, I just don't know what to do. I'm nervous. And, you know, so she's going to, you know, for her, it's about being able to go out there and have a bigger impact and make sure that she gets the best return on her investment of time and energy for the last 30 years of running a business. And the impact on her will be huge. She'll get that 50 million. It'll come back into this country and she'll pump it through the system. And so, you know, it's a loose term is impact, but it can go across, you know, it can be helping somebody get, I've done presentation skills with sixth formers on how to do interviews for university. So it's not just entrepreneurs, it could be anything, people getting contracts. So I worked with a guy in Dewsbury who does porter cabins, and I went, he was doing a pitch for 75 million quid worth of work. And he texted me the moment he got it and said, I wouldn't have got it without you. And that pays for a lot of wages, a lot of mortgages, a lot of clothes on kids' backs. So, yeah, that's why I do presentation skills. When I did brain training, which is what I started out, the impact was a lot lower. People like improving the memory, but it doesn't matter that much. Mind mapping is a great skill, but really, benefit, a bit negligible. Presentation skills. When people in key positions stand up and smash it out of the park in front of others, whether it's a team meeting in front of their internal, you know, staff, whether it's external talking to shareholders or investors, it's huge.
Yeah, agreed. Well, David, I actually got a question for you before we finish, which is from Steve. I know Steve has a huge impact in your life. And I asked him, I said, look, I'm interviewing David. I think he's seeing you soon anyway, but I asked him, have you got a question that you'd like to give? And he said, what message or advice would you give to 16-year-old David?
That's a very common question I hear people say, you know, if you went back, what would you do? I'm not sure, really. I'm not sure, because I think if you were going to give advice about that, then they were going to be able to use and apply, then you would assume that they would be able to have the capacity for change to apply it. So in my world of even just presentation skills, the thing that is the greatest deciding factor about how much people can apply what I teach is their capacity for change, not my ability as a presenter. Because everybody has limited capacity for change. If everybody had high capacity for change, we'd all be slim, athletic, fit, because we'd eat and exercise, we'd all run amazing businesses because we'd go out there and, you know. So the thing is that you're saying, you know, what advice would you give in terms of, you know, but the thing is, I didn't have the capacity for change at 16. I was in a mess. You know, life was just an absolute bag of shitty bollocks. And I was working in a factory for quid an hour. So I'm not sure if anything I could say to myself back then. The thing is, whatever I would have said to myself at 16 would have had no impact, none whatsoever. So I get the question. If you were to try and go, look, you know, if there's something that you need to know, understand about the next 40 years, give or take, then, you know, it would be nice if somebody was just to turn around and say that they believed in me, that I had the ability, that I knew that I was going to, if they just said, you know, that thing you did when you were 13, you went and became a runner. Yeah. You know, that drive that you had to become the best runner in the school. Yeah. You're going to have that forever. And it's going to take you all around the world. It's going to make you successful. You're going to write books. You're going to speak on platforms. You're going to speak at Caesar's Palace on the same stage as Jerry Seinfeld the night before. And you're going to impact millions of people. You know, just understand that's always going to be there, that drive. And it's inbuilt. It will never go away. It will always be there. And that's going to give you a quality of life you never knew existed. Then that would be nice to know. And that would be quite calming.
Yeah.
If I was to turn around and say something negative in terms of trying to avoid any pitfalls, I would definitely turn around and say, as difficult as this for me to say in a public arena, you know, relationships have been a tricky issue for me ever since I was 18. And it would have been, and the thing is that you could say, oh, you've got five great kids and you've got Karen. And so it all came good in the end. No, there's some stuff that's happened that took me to the brink of suicide as an adult. And so therefore, I think the most important thing would have been, on a personal level, just take a breath before you jump into a relationship. That would be the biggest thing I'd say. Because the thing is, as a kid, I always say that most people have one really good parent that they get on well with and one that they don't always get on as well with. That's just the nature of the beast. And I think if you've got one parent you're really close to and you get on okay with the other, you're doing pretty good. For me, I didn't have one good parent, one bad parent. I had three bad parents. I had two bad parents and an absent parent because my dad disappeared to America when I was 11. He disappeared to Newcastle when I was 6, got married, didn't invite us to the wedding. Went to America when I was 11, still alive. We have pretty much a non-existent relationship. We keep in touch and we speak, email and whatever, but we have no personal relationship at all of any kind. My stepfather was 75 by the time I was 16, never showed me the way how to be a man. And of course, my mother had her issues as well, and the drinking just got worse and worse. So the thing is, then when I went out and started getting drinking heavily, relationships evolved out of that. Things have been interesting and not always great. And I've got some scars to show for that.
So, fascinating answer. Yeah. Thank you, David. Thank you. Well, thank you for also coming on as well. This has been an absolutely amazing episode. And obviously, I didn't even ask a lot of the stuff actually I was going to ask. So yeah, I appreciate where this has gone to. It's been really fascinating. David, if people want to find out more about you, where can they go?
CreatingPresentationRockstars.com.
Fantastic. And you've also got a podcast as well, if people are interested as well.
Powerful Presenting for Leaders. Now it's about 150 episodes. I make them short, punchy, 20 minutes long. It's just me chit-chatting. I don't do interviews. I've got a couple of things on there where I've interviewed one or two people, but almost all of them are just me chit-chatting, giving powerful tips on how to be amazing. Because that's what I do. I create presentation rock stars.
Love it. David, thank you for being on Unlocked. And yeah, good luck and best wishes for next year for the bodybuilding. Yeah. Thanks, mate. Cheers.
Yeah, luck is what I'll need.